Welcome to MacGuffin Men. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. You can check out our website, themacguffinmen.com. We most recently talked about Dunkirk, and before that was Prisoners, The Thing, and Baby Driver. And I've also written a bunch of things recently about Lord, The Strokes, and how people think about them now, as well as something on Annette Bening and Michael Douglas, and something about Jay-Z's new album that is about, like, five other things as well. At The MacGuffin Men on Twitter. You can follow us if you like. You can tell your friends if you like. And that's about it.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
All right.
Yep.
One of our world famous twofers.
I can't believe you're spiking this episode for a week for Dunkirk. Don't the people want our hot Guy Ritchie takes from the year 2000?
Yeah, exactly. The most recent of these films is 17 years old. I do enjoy the very Nolan-y order we are recording that podcast in, and that neither of us has seen Dunkirk, and yet I promoted the podcast on it.
God, can't start too early or late.
But we're going to talk about Nolan plenty in the next or most recent episode, whichever way you want to look at it. But today is all about Guy Ritchie. Somebody who I can't imagine would get along all that well with Christopher Nolan. I don't think they'd be buds.
Based on filmmaking style alone?
Filmmaking style and general vibes, you know?
General Madonna marrying vibes.
Yeah, that, and also I feel like there's a period in Guy Ritchie's life where he loved cocaine. I think we are watching movies from that period. I feel like Christopher Nolan has seen cocaine once and ran away from it, you know?
His hardest drug is oolong tea.
Exactly. It's so hard, it's got double vowels. So, Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels, I assume, is where we will start.
We're, as you said, it's a twofer, so we're talking about Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels, as well as Snatch, his breakthrough movies, and we will talk about both. I imagine there'll be a lot of back and forth, and we will be the first people to point out that they are similar films.
I will straight up mix up these movies a bunch of times. Like, it's gonna happen. I was rereading the synopses for these movies just before the podcast, because it's been a couple days since I watched them, and I totally, like, in my head, that glass that's dropped on the glass table, that was in Snatch. In reality, it's in Lock, Stock, you know? Like, and I feel like these things will happen a few times, you know?
Yeah, and you'd be forgiven for that mistake, that's for sure.
Oh, you're so kind.
Let's start with Lock, Stock. Mm-hmm. This was a movie that, you know, I think he just had a short film before this and wanted to try to get a film career off the ground. And he's, Guy Ritchie's one of those guys who kind of had an education going and really, really just wanted to be involved with in the film industry somehow. So kind of made his way into some entry level jobs in the film industry and really just kind of worked his way up. And so he's only 30 for Lock, Stock, which is pretty impressive. I mean, that's very young for a director, not very young for your first career, but very young for a director to be making a movie even of this size.
Yeah, exactly. And that was a time when youth in filmmaking was trusted way more. I mean, we mentioned Christopher Nolan, Quentin Tarantino, Paul Thomas Anderson. These are all people that are starting their careers around the same time and around the same age. You know, like, I think Quentin Tarantino might have still been in his 20s when he made Reservoir Dogs, you know? It was just like this weird time where it's like people in their late 20s are fantastic directors. And people were willing to give those directors money, you know? In some cases, more money than others. But
yeah, and it's that's a good draft class of directors right there, actually.
Yeah. I mean, Guy Ritchie's coming off the bench, which in most, like, most of the time would be pretty, like, pretty fantastic. Like that's proof that your starting five is amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. And this also brings us the beginning of Vinnie Jones' acting career.
Yeah, like such a big part of I think the success of Lock, Stock is Guy Ritchie's ability to find actors that. I mean, Vinnie Jones is fantastic. I love Vinnie Jones. I was not done with him as an actor before North American culture decided we were done with him. I think yeah. Around the time he said, "I'm the Juggernaut bitch" in X-Men: The Last Stand, I think that was when we all turned. But I think Vinnie Jones is fantastic, and I wish he played a heavy in like every action movie I see for the rest of my life. And I might feel even more positively about Jason Statham, who is like, I feel like we have both sung his praises on this podcast, but I think he's just one of the most charismatic people in the world.
Yeah, and
these are both like totally unknown actors at the time of Lock, Stock, and they're tens, you know.
Yeah, and I think you sort of broached the subject talking about how much Guy Ritchie probably loves cocaine during this period of his life. These are big, pretty wild movies, but I think Jason Statham's really good in both of these, and it's not like he's going as big and wild as Vinnie Jones gets to go, and I think he still does a pretty good job of it.
Yeah, I mean, Jason Statham's best traits are playing the straight man, but somebody that is also kind of a little sarcastic about it. You know, he's like, he is the person that is the most normal in these insane situations, but he's also cognizant of how insane these situations yeah. are. And that's exactly what he's the best at, you know?
Yeah.
Because I think that's kind of how Jason Statham views his life. He's like, I live in this very, well, now that he's, Hollywood actor working in Fast and Furious movies and stuff, I think his day-to-day life is like, this is insane. Like, what I'm doing is so bizarre. I don't know how I got here. It's fantastic. I'm going to keep cracking jokes and being charming, you know?
Yes. Yeah. And so, could you pick a favorite of these two, or do you just want to talk about Lock, Stock?
I think it's Snatch. Yeah. Yeah. And just because... it's weird, like I saw Snatch once in theaters, I think on opening night. Actually, I know it was opening night, and then once again on DVD probably like 5 or 6 years later, and I loved it in theaters and remember being very disappointed when I on the second viewing for some reason, and just watching it this week, such a good time. Like, because yeah. it is Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels, but more polished, you know. Like, there are so many similarities, right down to, like you said, Vinnie Jones playing the same character in two movies, and I think his outro in one movie is the same as his intro in another.
Yeah, back at the guy's head in the car door.
Exactly. Yeah. I couldn't remember if that was his exact last scene in Lock, Stock. It can't be, because he drops off the Sotheby's thing, but anyway, doesn't matter. But yeah, watching them again now, more than 10 years removed from that viewing, Snatch is definitely the clear winner, just because they're so similar. But Snatch, just there's just like a level of craft that exists in Snatch that doesn't exist in Lock, Stock, presumably because of budget, you know?
Yeah, and I mean,
Lock, Stock is almost 10 times the budget, or sorry, Snatch is almost 10 times the budget of Lock, Stock.
Yeah, and just obviously being, you know, 2 years older and having the experience that he had, as well as the budget and other people helping him out. And I know that there's carryover from film to film as well. But like, Tim Maurice Jones is the cinematographer on both. But I imagine it's just more experience for everybody, and I'm sure some advice from other people.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And also the cast of actors he's able to get in Snatch is just more talented.
Yeah, he's able to, get rid of Benicio del Toro pretty quickly. That's the embarrassment of riches he has.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, for me, it's Snatch by a long shot, too. It's just watching it this time, being more mindful of this. Like, this is the first time I've watched these movies as close together as I have in the amount of time. I've seen them both multiple times, but... It doesn't look like an expensive movie, but I think just the way that his filmmaking is so propulsive and interesting and kinetic and fun, it seems like it should be more expensive than it is still. I find that with Lockstock the most.
Yeah, I get that. He is somebody that can do a lot with very little. That's something that is definitely true of Guy Ritchie, and I think part of it is that because so much of his style is very the things that are stylish about his I guess filmmaking style are his framing choices. And also so much of what makes a movie a Guy Ritchie movie happens in editing. And some of these shots just are on screen for so little time that that's sort of like we don't even realize how quickly it might have been set up because we don't have time to register everything that's going on in the shot. And then they're stitching together all these things in editing so quickly that it makes it feel bigger than it actually is, you know, just because of how propulsive the films are, you know. Because if you look at the sets, especially of Snatch, every room is so small, like almost comically small. Yeah. And like that type of thing is where you can see the budget constraints a little bit. I think that was also by design, but it certainly helps you keep this movie that comes in at $10 million feeling like a lot more.
Yeah, and I think that's absolutely it. And I think that it is just it doesn't take a lot of money to tilt the camera, you know, to do on its side sort of or on an angle. It doesn't take a lot of money to edit, at least not anymore, at least not even at this point compared to how much that would have cost dealing with tons and tons of film.
Yeah, exactly. The Avid exists by this point, so you can cut digitally.
Yeah, and so I think that when you watch these movies, and you know, just take a great example in Lockstock of a scene that just looks really good but isn't for financial reasons, is their, you know, their party scene when they celebrate after the robbery, and it's the four guys and they're drinking and passing out on the piano and stuff. It's just so pleasing to the eye and so fun, and it's not a spectacle in the sense that it's this huge vista and there's things exploding or there's 1,000 extras that you can tell are really extras reacting to something. It's just that when something is so aesthetically interesting and weird, it just seems like it should cost more money. But if this is four people in a small pub drinking and the camera just dancing around them in a very interesting way and doing these tricks, you know, to, you know, they don't spin the camera, but the frame spins, the image spins, and they reverse it, and they speed up time and they slow it down. And as you said, the editing technology at that point is there to do this really cheaply, but there's still this sense of it's still very impressive and it's still very whimsical. It just seems like it should be someone burning cash, but it doesn't have to be at this point. And I think that's tough to do in an interesting way without it seeming super gimmicky. And both of these movies, I think, are probably the epitome of style over substance, but it doesn't come off as just stylish for the sake of stylish and not that fun to watch other than you're looking at someone learn how to do these things, right?
Yeah. And I mean, they're definitely style over substance, but there is a level of things come together, things wrap up well enough that the style over substance, it kind of doesn't matter. Like I had a very good time watching both of these movies, you know. It's like, and there were parts of Snatch, like the Snatch, the where's the, is it Boris the Blade that gets hit by the car?
Yeah.
That sequence, I like, I was just like tickled by that sequence. I thought it was so fantastic because I had a uncanny memory of Snatch for some reason and just the way things played out. And I totally forgot that scene and it made me laugh so hard. The way that there's no setup for the time jumps that are happening, you have to figure it out on your own. The fact that it's just straight up very funny. And all of that was fantastic. And another scene that was like that is the all bets are off scene. That the build of that to the door opening at the end of that scene, it's just so funny. That whole sequence is amazing and just made me laugh so hard, you know. And they're just unbelievably fun movies to watch, and I don't feel like I get a lot out of them, that's for sure.
Yeah.
So the style certainly comes over substance, but when the style is this entertaining, I don't care, you know.
Oh, you know, completely.
I mean, we're both big fans of mostly hollow action movies, and these are mostly hollow action movies.
Yeah. Yeah, just quickly, her pointing over her other shoulder to point to the word off, and Fantastic. All bets are off. Fantastic. It's such a small thing that I love. No, I do think they absolutely wrap up well, and I think Snatch, I mean, I do enjoy the ending of Lockstock as well. But I think the ending of Snatch, as we said, both of these are style over substance, and I think that that film wrapping up as well as it did really makes it a lot better. I mean, it's fun the whole time. Both of these are what I would say are good hang movies, you know? That's why both of these movies had a TV show come out of them, because you're not that concerned with what's Turkish going to do next, or how does Mickey, you know, live the rest of his life, you know, as much as that might be interesting. These movies are more about the feel and more about the world that you get into, and just this idea that we can tell a bunch of different stories in this style, or at least we can try to, and that'll be entertaining because the world and the style was so much fun. Mm-hmm. But with Snatch, and my forgiveness for jumping around, the end of that,
the same thing. I
think the end of that, it kind of lets you dwell on the weight of what's been happening for the first time. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously we're sad that when Mickey's mom dies,
we're absolutely distraught.
Yeah. You know,
I mean, not really, but
no, but I mean, we understand that that's a heavy moment. Yeah, there are deaths in this movie that don't come off as heavy moments at all.
Yeah.
And, Mickey's mother's not one of them. And I think that they just do such a good job in that last probably 8 minutes of getting a bit of weight on it, so you can kind of realize that what you've seen was this whole expansive story with these ups and downs, and you know, there's some actual heart to it for a bit, and you enjoy the revenge plot a lot more than you would if it was just silliness. And it still ends on a laugh, you know. It does go back to goofy before the you know, before the credits roll. Hey, which man, is
gotta complete that rule of threes.
Yeah, that's right. But I think that, yeah, it is so much fun, but I think they do a great job of putting a bit of an emotional button on it to appreciate kind of everything that you make you appreciate everything of what you've just seen, and give it a bit more emotional heft than they've been interested in dealing with for the whole time.
Yep. Yep. I get that.
Yeah.
And also not a freeze frame ending, which is nice.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
You get some freeze frames throughout the
documentary. Oh yeah, there's tons of freeze frames. I'm not even mad about the freeze frame ending in Lockstock, because my take on the freeze frame ending is always you are introducing a new aspect of your style in the last shot of your movie, which is not the case in Lockstock.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. I don't know. I kind of don't even know how to talk about these movies separately because they're so similar. Like, I feel like we should be talking about Lockstock more, but I also feel like when we're talking about Snatch, we're talking about Lockstock. It's very difficult. This movie's put us in a very difficult conversational place.
I tried to address that early because I'm not at all surprised by that. And I think that they're both worth a watch. You know, I think if you had seen Snatch first, it's not a bad idea to watch Lockstock. I mean, it is very derivative, and it's such a training wheels movie that the training wheels ride just goes really well. Lockstock.
Yeah.
You know, as we said, he's got a distinctive style. He reuses so many actors. The plots are kind of similar, at least the way that the subplots interact with each other. But you know, to look at it in a linear fashion, is this purely just British Quentin Tarantino for Lockstock, or is there something distinct there? Or do you want to try to talk about that line, because it's rereading reviews from that time period, almost all of them mentioned Quentin Tarantino, and I don't think they're wrong to, but I just wanted to see kind of the way that you connect the dots between those two, and that's a good way to talk about Lockstock because it did come first.
Yeah, I will say, like, QT was the shadow over pretty much every post 1994 filmmaker, especially those that made crime movies. But anybody operating at a less than studio Hollywood level, they had to deal with at least one Quentin Tarantino question in their junkets, you know? That was how big of a sensation Pulp Fiction was. It was it changed the way cinema was looked at and discussed, and it got a lot of people a lot of very, very talented people jobs, that like people that we were listing off earlier. I will say one thing that I loved about Lock, Stock, that is a Lock, Stock specific thing, is Guy Ritchie gets a credit for casting. Like, there's a casting agent that's credited. And then also after that, you get casting Guy Ritchie, which I have never seen. I've never seen a director get a casting credit, because I feel like a director could take a casting credit on just about any movie.
Yeah, right.
So like I was fascinated by that, because presumably the director has some sort of sign off on at least most of the people in the movie. I can't imagine if once the studio found out that Brad Pitt wanted to be in Snatch, that Guy Ritchie even would be able to say no if he wanted to. But like for most movies and most characters, the director picks these or has the final sign off. So I'm curious to know, like, I know there was a long casting process for Lock, Stock, and for a movie of its budget, it is really hard to get actually talented people, especially since there are so many unknowns in the cast. I think it's like 17 of the 44 actors in the movie had never acted before. Some sort of crazy number like that. And
yeah, so that's just a numbers game, right? Like, just see everybody.
Exactly. And the fact that he found two people as charismatic as Vinnie Jones and Jason Statham, who just looks so natural on screen, and just... I can see why he wanted to take a casting credit, because it's pretty amazing. Because that's such a, for especially for a director's first movie, there are a lot of roles in Lock, Stock. There are a lot of people to cast. Like, again, going with the QT example, you find most directors' first movie that when they don't have a budget, you'll make a small movie because you can't afford a big movie, you know, like Reservoir Dogs. Where does it take place? All in one location, or primarily all in one location. There are, for the most part, five actors. And just, it's all the way that you can make, it's a bottle episode movie for the most part, you know, whereas Lock, Stock is very sprawling. It's a lot of confined places, but it is still like physically a fairly sprawling movie, and certainly the cast is sprawling as well. So that's something that I think
even just to have, just by having so many sets and so many locations, you just have one person who does one or two lines, you know, they're not all going to the same bar. So you need one bartender, right? You've got all these different locations. There's different pubs. There's a Samoan pub, you know, there's so much of everything. Yeah,
exactly. And I think that's something that is, that's very impressive to do, and very difficult, you know, like, so that's something that I commend Guy Ritchie for. And it's a specifically Guy Ritchie thing, because I think when you think about, most of the directors in that quote unquote draft class, of the 90s, most people, if you compare their first film, Guy Ritchie's might feel like the biggest, you know, which I think is impressive.
Yeah, absolutely.
And even though, like, say, Paul Thomas Anderson, Sydney/Heart 8 takes place in Vegas or Atlantic City, I forget which one, there's still only like eight actors in that movie, you know.
it's a
movie that takes place in a big place, but most of the scenes are small. But yeah, so that's the thing about Guy Ritchie that I think is definitively like his, and impressive about him, is how he can make such large movies out of such, you know, small budgets. But yeah, The Shadow of QT, especially for a movie like Lock, Stock, which is these wisecracking criminals, it's not like there's a heavy pop culture reference, heavy amount of pop culture references running through these movies. They talk about a Madonna song. I think that's about it.
And I think that's a Quentin Tarantino thing.
Oh yeah, that is true. Like an homage to the like aversion scene in Reservoir Dogs. But they're just both. They both made crime movies about people that didn't necessarily see crime as something to sit and ponder and be like, I'm doing bad. I'm doing bad things with my life. It's just like, this is my life, and I'm going to live it like any other human would live their life in a 9-to-5, you know, with wisecracking, very charismatic people. And I think that's pretty much it for the similarities. Like, the way that Quentin Tarantino makes his movies, and the thing that has helped him stand apart from the rest of those people that came along with him or got jobs because of him, is that he's more of he finds his directorial ideas in his writing, whereas somebody like Guy Ritchie, it really feels like the things that make a movie a Guy Ritchie movie come in editing because of the quick pace and everything. Like, Quentin Tarantino doesn't have any fast cut movies. Like, Kill Bill 1 is probably the fastest cut movie he's ever made, and it's not like that's a frenetic pace for most of it, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas Guy Ritchie's so editing heavy, you know? And there is a difference, but, you know, with a wide angle lens, not looking at these films too closely, you can really see the similarities between Lock, Stock and Reservoir Dogs, or just how people would find those similarities, and Snatch and Pulp Fiction, and not just because the budgets for Reservoir Dogs and Lock, Stock are almost identical and the same for Snatch and Pulp Fiction. You can really see it from afar, but once you start looking at the movies closer together, they're not that similar. Snatch is sort of like adding more Hollywood to the mix. You know, Brad Pitt is your John Travolta, I guess. And Dennis Farina, you know, this character actor that could have conceivably been in Lock, Stock, but wouldn't have had a way to get to the script of Lock, Stock, you know, just because they're operating in totally different worlds. So you can see those comparisons, but like when you really look at the movies, they're not that similar. And I also feel like Pulp Fiction specifically, like that's a movie that's about free will, is how I always look at it. Like John Travolta and Samuel L. Jackson's characters, they're basically throughout the movie having a conversation about free will, and they go in different ways at the end of the movie, or their end of the movie. But I don't really get anything out of Snatch. You know, I think you are Snatch or Lockstock. I think you're 100% right that Snatch's patience at the end gives it more of a weight, but still the ending is basically like most people are idiots and all of these criminal follies are funny to watch, you know?
Yeah, and I think the big two things people would say about Quentin Tarantino is the pop culture references, which, you know, I think you've correctly stated about Guy Ritchie. He does not seem as interested. Mm-hmm. There's a levity to everything that kind of makes it seem pop culture-y, you know what I mean? As you said as well, they're not brooding over the morality of what they're doing. So it just seems like other pop culture products because it's lighter and fluffier in a way, even when it is dealing with crime.
It's a very Generation X movie, you know?
Right,
like, that sort of like nothing really matters sort of vibe that was very prevalent in the 90s.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, has continued. I think that's the 90s, the 90s legacy in art is that people basically turning to the camera and saying, nothing matters, you know?
Yeah, and then the second part of the Quentin Tarantino, I think, you know, main ingredients in his cookbook would be dealing with intense violence. Mm-hmm. And these movies play off violence, you know, things are often dealt with less horrifically than they should be dealt with. You know, you just Boris the Blade being shot several times for humor's sake. Mm-hmm. The offhandedness in which Boris the Blade shoots Frankie Four Fingers and, you know, in the head, just in a very matter of fact way to move on to the next thing and not really consider it. That's not the Quentin Tarantino intense violence at all. You know, it's, as I said, there's no gravity to it, but it's not reveling in the violence either.
Yeah.
And the amount of, I mean, I think I saw there's 26 deaths in Snatch, and it just doesn't feel like there is that many. Mm-hmm. And I think it's because so many are off screen and there's never the ear of the cop being cut off that we just sit there and have to dwell on. And, you know, that awful feeling sticks with you after the movie's done.
Yeah, and I mean, semi-famously sort of makes the movie feel more violent than it actually is. Like, people have always felt like the way people talk about Quentin Tarantino's the violence in his movies and how much violence there actually is way out of whack. But it's because when he does dwell on it, he really dwells on it. And
yeah, because I think two or three people die in all of Reservoir Dogs, or three or four. It's a pretty low number considering the gut-wrenching feeling associated with it.
Yeah,
as it, a picture.
It's a low number, but it's also a high percentage in Reservoir Dogs, you know?
Oh, yeah, I guess that's true.
Yeah, so I can sort of see that side of
17 to 44 characters have speaking parts and they all die.
Yeah, but I mean, with it, and with the way that you're talking about death in Guy Ritchie movies, these Guy Ritchie movies, is that you're right in that most of it, it seems like the majority of people that die in Snatch die off screen. And the one time I can think of where it's not, where death is not, or murder, specifically murder, is not played for laughs is when Brad or Mickey's mom dies. Like, that seems to be the only time when we dwell on the death of a human. And they do they show that for a little bit, you know?
At least it's more than a domino. It's usually this person's death is going to have some fallout, this person's death is sad in and of itself because a human being was murdered by another human being.
Exactly. Yeah, you're exactly right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, with the exception of Mickey's ma, everybody is just a domino, because nothing really matters, as film in the 90s taught us.
Yeah. And so I was just thinking about this, just in thinking about Quentin Tarantino when thinking about Guy Ritchie and the way that they have a distinctive style and the way that the auteur theory always comes up in the discussion when we talk about, I mean, particularly Guy Ritchie's first few movies. It seems to be largely out of the picture now in a way that it hasn't really faded as much for Quentin Tarantino. What is the kind of broad appeal of thinking about those movies in the auteur style? Is it to kind of be on the in crowd and be able to recognize things? Because especially with Quentin Tarantino, it's such a fan club for the most part. You know? Like, obviously lots of people like his stuff and critics continue to give it up. It's not just that it's a small group of people, but is it about being kind of in on the joke and being the insular community, or is it about knowing what you're getting, or what do you think the appeal is there? And even from an audience standpoint and from a critical standpoint.
So if you take a movie, where I think from an audience standpoint and critical standpoint, it's not all that different. From a critical standpoint, the thing that makes it different from an audience, or at least a common audience, is that it makes movies easy. Like, it gives you more angles to a movie. Like, anytime Quentin Tarantino releases a new movie, you can talk about it in the context of things that he's done before. You know, it's just sort of famously the auteur theory is the creation of a film critic, you know? And it sort of helps the critics further pieces about this director become easier, you know? And even if it's, say, you're writing about Lockstock, you can write your review about Lockstock and then be like, I wonder where he'll go next, you know? And just sort of maybe even hypothesize a little bit about it. So for critics, it just makes their job easier, and it makes it easier to write a more engaging, wide-ranging piece about a filmmaker and their films.
You've already got it in before you've even seen the movie, right?
Exactly. Just because it is the way that critics have almost exclusively collectively decided to talk about films. It's that all of the films directed by Guy Ritchie are at least in some way related. You know, when King Arthur came out, it's like, well, he's using slow motion again because that's what Guy Ritchie does, you know, which isn't that prominent in Snatch and Lockstock, but certainly like his bigger budget movies, he uses a lot of slow motion. Sherlock Holmes to the most enjoyable extent. I didn't see King Arthur. Travis said it was good, but I'll get around to it eventually. But yeah, so for people like yourself or myself that just sort of like watching movies and with a at least mildly obsessive in a sort of way, in your case, in a very obsessive way in my case, I think it all comes back to anytime somebody gets really attached to an artist, and this applies to musicians as well, or any sort of artist, it's because the work that they have made has really engaged you, your mind, and it sort of feels like, I think like subconsciously, on some sort of subconscious level, when I love Pulp Fiction, I become more interested in Quentin Tarantino because I feel like Quentin Tarantino can communicate with something in me that I didn't know existed, you know? And I think that you want to get to know the artist that made that work better, because you feel like that artist knows you, and you feel like by getting to know them better, even though you'll never actually meet them, you start to get closer and closer to the person that you actually are, and you start to learn things about yourself, and you realize that 20 years later, I still love Quentin Tarantino movies. So despite the fact that he's a kooky cokehead, he and I probably have some sort of similarity deep in our brains, that despite being very different people, he is able to understand me, despite the fact that we have never been in the same room together, you know? And yeah, he's never thinking, I'm making a movie to please Alex. He just happens to do it consistently, you know? So I think that is always and even just somebody to take it to another example, like somebody that's screaming somebody that's young screaming over a pop star, let's say Harry Styles, maybe like something in the One Direction music just got touched them in some way that they then sort of are like, oh my God, I love this person that is in One Direction. And I think on a very basic level, it still comes back to this person made this thing that I love. Ipso facto, this person understands me a little bit. So I want to get to know them better.
Yeah, that makes sense. And
it sounds very grandiose, but I think that is at the core of people that want to learn about artists that make art that they like.
Right, but I'm just thinking back to, I mean, I think macro, that's absolutely true. I'm just bringing it back to Guy Ritchie and the way that we've talked about him being somewhat style over substance. Mm-hmm. When it's a musician or an author or a poet or someone who, you know, it's just a lot more direct communication than all the people that get involved in making a film. And just that, as we said, it's so stylish that what's there, you know what I mean? And I'm not saying that he's not a talented filmmaker, because I think he absolutely is. And I think these first two movies are really, really great. And I've seen Snatch so many times. And like the quick sidebar, when they pour those diamonds out on the white table with all the lights under it.
Yeah.
Like I've just a quick flashback of all the times that woke me up when I like put this movie on to fall asleep and then the TV gets super bright.
That's really funny.
Yeah, like that's the first thing that popped back in my head.
So that's your Can't Hardly Wait DVD menu, because that is something that woke me up.
I knew you'd have one. I didn't know what I was gonna try to guess, but I didn't know what it'd be. Yeah, but it's not that he's not a talented filmmaker, because I think he is. But when you say there's nothing here for you in the sense that there's no theme, like there's no strong message being communicated, how do we connect with someone like that?
Well, I mean, one, I just don't follow his career, you know, like I have not followed his career all that closely. I don't know much about him as a person. And I think that's sort of proof to the point, is that like, I know that he can make good movies. I liked both of his Sherlock Holmes movies, the first one a lot, and the second one I certainly liked more than most. But I also hated The Man from U.N.C.L.E. I never saw Swept Away. Can't imagine I would like it. there's just like the consistency just isn't there for me to really get interested in this person, like I have in a lot of other filmmakers whose consistency is just way better. Yeah, and I think that is sort of indicative of the style over substance to an extent. But also the thing about him that, to go back to the example I was saying, that I feel like connects with me is that he... Like, I wrote this thing about the Jay-Z album that I wrote. I talked a lot about how a lot of 3.5-star movies are being treated like 5-star movies just because of the way that Rotten Tomatoes has changed criticism. Like, Baby Driver is a 3.5-star movie that's being treated like a 5-star movie, right? Yes. And I love 3.5-star movies, 3.5-star movies, you know? Like, that is the... When I would be reading or looking at... Back when I read movie reviews when I was a teenager, if I wanted to see an action movie, the best rating that movie could get is 3.5 stars, because I knew it would be...
Not so full of itself that it's reaching for a 5.
Exactly. But it would just be a well-made action movie. And the movies I find that a lot of the movies that I really enjoy and think are really fun... but don't necessarily want to think about for all that much after are 3.5-star movies that are made like 5-star movies, and Lock, Stock, and Snatch both feel like that, because the level of talent that I think Guy Ritchie has sort of outweighs the emptiness of the movies, you know?
Yeah, and I think I had a suspicion Baby Driver would come up in this, because, you know, it's a movie made by a British guy kind of around the same age, who I think we both said style over substance a lot with that too. There are some things that emotionally worked with you more than it sounds like either of these two Guy Ritchie movies did, but it's just a very meticulously crafted movie, and you know, it's much more apparent with music and the timing of the cuts in Baby Driver matching up with each other. Mm-hmm. And this is editing, but not the same kind of impressive editing, but it still just makes it very, very propulsive. So I think there's a comparison to be made there. And
yeah, also, what's with British auteurs just being terrible at writing women? Between Guy Ritchie, Edgar Wright, and Christopher Nolan, that's a trifecta of terrible.
that is a monster trifecta. Once you threw Christopher Nolan in there too.
Yeah,
the women are nowhere to be found in these two movies. Let's just get that out of the way.
Let's get that out of the way at the 40-minute mark.
Let's give them the credit that these directors really deserve.
Exactly. Britain loved that we waited that long, apparently.
I just think it's kind of, even talking about the 3.5-star action movie that you're just discussing, it does just take a certain amount of craft and being very, very good at it. And I'm amazed by how well Snatch moves along. You know, I think Lock, Stock is good at it, but I think Snatch is incredible at it. And there's just so many things. I mean, we've kind of brushed off that he clearly has a visual style and that it's good without really getting to the specifics of it. But, you know, you talked about the slow motion, just speeding up and slowing down the footage in this movie, I think, does a great job of milking the interesting points and just glazing over the things that might not be so interesting. Mm-hmm. I think Avi's little airplane montages are a great laugh every time.
Every time.
And the third one, when he says anything to declare, yeah, don't go to fucking England.
I think that's the second one.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That's a fantastic laugh. Like, that's so good. But
a quick pause for Dennis Farina being the best actor of all time.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But I think that was the one kind of bit, if you will call it that, that I think did a good job of summing up Guy Ritchie, especially among these first two films, is that it's all about fun. Like, geography and time don't matter. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously time gets played with in a very interesting way, and time, it really does matter in how these lives intersect. But temporally and geographically, everything goes out the window to make this a really good movie. And as I said, like, time doesn't mean anything, but time also means everything. Geography doesn't mean anything, but it also means everything. And even just the setup of some of the shots, the way it's such a small thing that I didn't really notice till it was pointed out to me. And then you watch the movie again and you think about it, but just the way that a frame is composed, in that it leads your eye to a certain spot in the frame, and then they go to a new angle, and your eye is already where it needs to be to take in what he wants you to see next, or what he wants you to focus on. Mm-hmm. Like, that takes an incredible amount of thought and of craft and of great filmmaking by a director and a cinematographer and an editor to set these things up. And, you know, you can't find that stuff in the editing booth unless you've shot everything. Like, there's just no way to stumble across that. I mean, maybe once in a while it happens, but to the degree that works in this film, I think is incredible and does so much to give it that propulsive feel. And I know we've said that term a few times, and not to be repetitive, but just the way that the music and the levity and the charisma and the framing of so much of this movie, it just hums along, and it's just such a fun ride. And I think that is, it's such a style over substance thing, but it lets you just so easily sink into this world and like let it wash over you and just enjoy enjoy the craftsmanship and the performances so well. And I think that that's really the masterstroke of Snatch for me.
Yeah, for sure. And it's not like just by being, by having some sort of substance makes your movie good, you know? There are countless movies that I hate specifically because they're lectures about something important, you know? And they're just executed in the most boring milquetoast way possible, and they just are terrible movies, and there's nothing there to cover up how nakedly boring they are. Whereas at least Snatch is super entertaining, you know? I'm not learning anything about the human condition.
Yeah.
But I don't want to learn anything about the human condition every single time I watch the movie. In the best case scenario, that's what happens. But sometimes you just see a Guy Ritchie movie, you walk in, and an hour and 40 minutes later, you walk out, and you had a great time in the middle.
Yeah.
And you laughed really hard at the second use of Viva Las Vegas. Which is, that's my specific memory of this movie, is the second time they did that, I laughed so hard. Like, way too hard.
But yeah, because that's such a one-off bit normally.
Yeah, and this is, I think this is very pre-Traffic for Benicio too. So yeah. I remember I liked him because he was good in the Bond movie he was in. So I had like, or in The Usual Suspects as well. So I had some sort of connection to Benicio before seeing this movie. But man, he's fun in this movie.
Well, yeah. And just for you, you get your Sound of Silence moment after in the boxing fight that never clicked with me until watching it just this most recent time.
What do you mean? I'm sorry?
When Brad Pitt's underwater.
Yeah. Yeah, of course.
But that is another thing that's shot so well, too, and cut together well. And the uppercut that sends him flying through the air is fantastic. And this movie never does. I mean, for all its wildness, it never really goes supernatural, and that splash into the water I think is super effective for that reason.
Absolutely. And just the match of the shots of Brad Pitt in the air in both of those, they must have been shooting on two cameras because it's so exact. And I can't imagine they faked it. They would have had to have Brad Pitt doing that jump, and he nails it. I can't imagine they would have asked for too many takes from one of the most famous people in the world to do that. Because it's physically a difficult shot for him. But yeah, it's gorgeous. The intercutting of those two hyper slow motion shots. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
And not just because of the beautiful man in the center of those shots.
I can't believe we've barely talked about Brad Pitt and Mickey O'Neill.
I know. And we've had opportunities to talk about Brad Pitt, and yet we have skipped over it. This is a first for the MacGuffin Man.
Yeah, really.
Normally we find a way to talk about him in movies he's not in.
Yeah. Just his whole character is a great kind of meta joke as well. You know, so many people saying they were having international audiences outside of Britain saying that they had a hard time with Lockstock. You know, they saw the appeal of it, but the accents were difficult to penetrate. And even beyond that, the Cockney rhyming slang, which, like, there's a percent of this of Lockstock I don't get. Mm-hmm. You know, there's just a couple lines of dialogue that just don't click with me, and I can't understand what they're saying. And I get the gist of it, but, you know, like, I couldn't explain it to a child if they asked me, that's for sure. And so that in Snatch, we just get a character that even the characters in the movie don't understand. I really like that move as well.
Yeah, for sure. And also, let's Brad Pitt have some fun, which is... is supporting actor Brad Pitt is I think my favorite version of Brad Pitt.
Yeah, I know. This is a character that doesn't need to be good looking, you know what I mean? And as in the other times we discussed Brad Pitt, it's the character actor that is just way too handsome to be a character actor. And this one, you know, we'll let him shit his first way into the his first entrance into the movie. And,
and not even like a bathroom shit.
No, not at all. Not very glorious a movie star like in any way. And
I bet he was so happy to be able to do that. That seems like something that would just make his day.
He's having as much fun making this as we had watching it. So
yeah, for sure. And I think him and Jason Fleming are like, honest to goodness, friends in real life, probably because of meeting on this movie. Jason Fleming played his dad in Benjamin Button, you know? I would imagine he had a great time on set. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Is there anything else you feel like we need to address?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I could list fun things about this movie for
a long
time. Yeah,
I think that's probably just what we would do, right?
Yeah.
The opening credit sequence is fantastic in Snatch. Like, the tying all those characters together. I mean, I don't have anything to say other than that, but that sequence is fantastic.
Yeah, I think we've got all the substance out of this exercise and style that we can.
Yeah, exactly. Except we didn't mention how, we discussed Quentin Tarantino a lot, but I feel like these movies are also very derivative of the Coen brothers, and I just want that to be on the record, you know, because these are, or at least certain Coen brothers movies, you know, the movies that are about idiot criminals, because these movies are about idiot criminals. And I feel like the Quentin Tarantino comparisons have always been very, very strong when discussing Guy Ritchie, especially when he was first coming up with Lock, Stock, and Snatch. But I feel like he takes at least as much from the Coen brothers, just in a sort of the style of character he's focusing on, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I get Fargo, you know, movie and television show, which I know they are very uninvolved with for the most part. And
but still, they totally inspired it, you know?
Yeah, oh, no, completely. And I think that that's, yeah, they took the things that you can take from the Coen brothers easily. They're talented filmmakers, and it's hard to make every type of movie they've made because that's a pretty wide swath at this point. But the goofy criminal, the bumbling killer kind of aspect is very much milked here.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, also Brad Pitt in a supporting role, which is a
that's true.
Notable Coen Brothers moment. But yeah, thank you for listening to us talk about a derivative filmmaker who's still good, you know, like, or at least still good in these movies that we've specifically discussed. His career got real up and down after this. But so thank you for listening to The MacGuffin Man. Be sure to check back next week when we'll be talking about something else.
Dunkirk.